Within moments of the disc's vanishing, something similar to a voice arose inside Mio's head. Accompanied by the drawing of vivid pictures in his mind, the voice thereafter spoke to Mio once a day. It requested that he answer, and seek answers of his own. "In the beginning, I didn't receive entire words or sentences," he explained to Stevens. "It was more like pictures. As time went by, these pictures became words and sentences. Later, I received messages in symbols. Once, I tried to draw one of these symbols, but I was not able to do it." Troubled by the voice and the pictures in his head, Mia had told Barson Zimmerman, the Protestant minister in the village, of the great flying disc he had seen and of the voice that had come into his head soon afterward. Zimmerman had a reputation in the village as somewhat of a mystic, far more liberal in his thinking than the parochial outlook of his parishioners. "I knew Parson Zimmerman," said Mia. "He was the family priest, and I used to play with his children. Another reason I probably went to see him was that even as a small child, I heard talk that he occupied himself with mystical matters. I told him about the experience I had together with my father, and then the voices I heard inside of me, the telepathic calls. That's why I went to him, because I thought I was going crazy. I used to go after school, it was not far from the schoolhouse. He told me that he knew about these flying objects. Back then, they were not called UFOs, this was nothing new to him. The people who flew in them would come from another world, not from Earth. He told me that he understood this, but that he could not talk about it. He was a priest and he would shock the people. He told me to try to learn telepathy, to try to give answers. So I tried as I was told. After a few weeks, it worked, and I was able to answer. I remember very well that Father Zimmerman told me not to talk about it to anyone, otherwise everybody would say I was crazy. Now, whenever he heard the voice speaking to him, the young Mia would try to direct his thoughts inward, and before long, he felt as if those thoughts made contact with something. The first reaction from the other side, he recalled, was like a gentle and fine laughter, which I heard deep inside of me and felt pleasant and relaxing. I still hear that laughter, but I can't define it. It was a very lovely laughter. Then, the contact faded away once more, and Mia neither heard a voice nor realized pictures. Suddenly, all was quiet again. On February 3, 1944, Mia's seventh birthday, a new voice, low and clear, came into his conscious mind and ordered me to learn and to collect knowledge transmitted to me. Mia feared that the clarity of this new voice meant he had finally succumbed to insanity. I was afraid because as a small boy, I hadn't any experience with the telepathic way. I again had to go to ask Barson Zimmerman what was happening, and he informed me, and I slowly understood. The low, clear voice Mia now heard belonged to an entity named Sfath, whose thought-transmitted teachings continued frequently through the summer of 1944. Then, one day in September, as Mia walked alone in a meadow, Sfath suddenly announced himself telepathically and told the boy he should wait there and not be afraid. "This was some time later and far from our home," said Mia. "It was 3 or 4 miles away behind a very big forest, a lonely place. There, I saw something falling down from the sky, very, very slow, and it became bigger and bigger. It was something like a metallic bear. Then, this ramp opened and it came out, going down like an elevator. I entered the ship and we went up very high above the earth. There was a very old man who looked to me like a patriarch. His name was Sfath. He was a human being, like each other one here on earth, only very old. We talked for hours, then he brought me back to the ground. The funny thing was, he knew my mother tongue better than I. The venerable Sfath told me he would remain his spiritual mentor only through the early 1950s, when a much higher form of life would assume the responsibility for further teaching. Mia had been selected for a mission, but Sfath revealed only that decades would pass before the boy knew its nature. Until that time, Mia had to be prepared to meet with many things, some that would cause him again to question his sanity, others that might bring physical harm. At the end of 4 hours, Sfath returned Mia to the meadow then departed, never to be seen again by the young boy. For many years thereafter, though, he had continued transmitting thoughts to Mia, preparing him, Mia felt, for the next step in his spiritual evolution. Then, on February 3, 1953, when Mia turned 16, Svath's voice had ceased in his mind forever. Several months passed before the silence was again filled with a new voice, at once present and talking to him. Unlike the soft and harmonic tone of Svath, the new voice sounded young and fresh, full of force. She was named Askit. G. Askit came from the dull universe. To your universe, it is unknown, she instructed Mia, but our universe is parallel to yours. It lies reckoned in your time on an equal plane. Many of the universes lie in time planes and spaces completely unknown to you. Because of technological developments, the barrier has been opened from our universe to yours. When Mia was 12, he spent 8 months in a tuberculosis sanatorium, and at 14, the local guardianship office sent him to the boy's home at Elbsbrough for being consistently truant. At Elbsbrough, he ran away 3 times before authorities returned him to his parents, and then he quit school before completing the 6th grade. As a young man, he worked at many jobs, from laying sewer pipe to milking dairy cows. Once, with several other young men, he was picked up by police for stealing and sent to a detention center at Aarberg, from which he again ran away, this time to France, where he joined the Foreign Legion, went to a few months after completing training, and returned to Switzerland and a detention center. He told Stevens that after his teenage years of reformatories and odd jobs, Askit had encouraged him to venture out into the world, to explore and to learn. Inspired by her telepathic teachings and her reassurance, Mia said he began his first travels into the Middle East in 1958. I was told to go over there myself and see what is really there, he said, because there is a connection with previous lives. The most important places were Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and Jordan. Very important again were West Pakistan, the foot of the Himalaya Mountains, and then India, mainly New Delhi and Merulai. And I have to add Turkey to this. All this has a connection with Emmanuel, that was his route and where he lived. I was told to get in touch with certain people, some of whom expected me. They were informed. In Merulai, I learned the teachings and philosophy of Buddha from a Buddhist monk. Weeks, even months had passed between contacts with Askit. Then, suddenly her voice would be inside his head again, indicating she desired to transmit information to him. Do you have time? She would say. Most often, he would say yes because her instruction was more important than anything else. And if he said yes, she would say, would you go to this place tomorrow and meet with these people? Or, I want you to go here and look at this. Or, I want you to go there and learn this. It is something very normal, he explained to Stevens. It's as if you called me and asked, Billy, do you have time for this? Same thing. Mia viewed such wanderings as part of the mission he had been given as a young boy. It was instructive. As he explained to Stevens, he was to get to know man, the soul of man, life of man, the background of the teachings. He was also to learn about nature. You learn a lot from nature, he said. You observe plants and animals, how everything exists, how it comes to life, how it dies, how it can live together. That's how I learned the laws and commands of nature. The laws and commands of nature are the same as the laws and commands of creation. Creation is not a separate power, creation is in everything. Working his way from Greece to Turkey, down through Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, into Saudi Arabia and out again through Kuwait, into Iran, further east to Pakistan and finally into India, Mia had traveled by land, in cars, by hitchhiking, by bus and by train and by ship. He found employment as a snake catcher and a gardener, drove a nitroglycerin truck, sang in the streets, waited tables, herded pigs, sailed an ocean-going tug, sold pots, pounded nails, supervised a youth hostel, prospected for rubies and gold, posed as a veterinarian, coached, worked as a male nurse, picked grapes, designed jewelry, performed puppet shows, raised chickens, and taught German, all. he told Stevens, under the tutelage of Arskett. During his travel, he acquired the nickname Billy, as a result of his infatuation with the American West and folk heroes Billy the Kid, Buffalo Bill, and Wild Bill Hickok. As Mia wandered from country to country, job to job, Arskett had continued the telepathic teachings begun by Svath, imparting to him even greater spiritual awareness. "You are selected as truth-offerer," she had revealed to him, "like numerous others at very early times before you. You have to become greater in knowledge than every other earthly human being of your time. Because of this, you have come under the controlling guardianship of a certain form of life which had to protect, lead, guide, and educate you. This embodies a law of the creation which cannot be acted against, even by will, for truth-offerers are not called for their mission at a certain age, they are destined from the time of procreation. Such a life will be difficult, for the creature concerned has extraordinary things to perceive." Near the coastal city of Iskenderun, Turkey, on August 3, 1965, winding his way out of the Middle East, Mia was riding in an old bus when it collided with another bus, throwing him out of a window. The accident severed his left arm just above the elbow. Mia told Stevens he had been left for dead by the side of the road and lay unconscious for several hours before a doctor happened by, checked him for signs of life, and had him taken to a local hospital. He spent 2 weeks there, and when he felt well enough to travel again, he continued on to Greece, where he settled into a hotel in Thessaloniki, selling shirts with German, "with my hand, my eyes, my mouth, with my feet, with a pencil and paper." At a party on Christmas Day of that year, he had met a 17-year-old Greek girl named Kalliopse Fyrou. While Mia was in India in 1964, Arskett had allowed him to photograph her spacecraft high above the Ashoka Ashram on the outskirts of Meruli. In the photograph, the craft appeared distinctly disc-shaped, topped by the slight rise of a dome, but otherwise undetailed. Mia still had the photograph and showed it to Stevens. That year, Arskett, as Svath before her, had left him. In her final contact, she had informed Mia that for his own benefit as well as that of his new contacts, he would be monitored for the next 11 years. At the end of that time, if assured that he had achieved the proper spiritual plane to allow face-to-face contact, the new beings would reveal their presence to him. "Your forefathers came from the constellation Lyra," Arskett had told Mia. "And when you have become mature enough to hear the new explanations concerning these matters, you will have the answers from the descendants of your forefathers themselves. The eternal truth remains for all times the eternal truth." And so ended Mia's story of his youthful encounters. Early the next morning, Stevens returned to the warmth and quiet of the Frith's small paneled dining room, where he drank a more strong tea and waded through the awkward English translation of Mia's first contact with the new life form, the Pleiadians. He had left off with the spacecraft finally alighting in the meadow. As Stevens began reading again, Mia's notes described the craft, which, now landed in the meadow, seemed to pulsate. Its nearly translucent, golden silver skin glinted in the sun. Except for the portholes around the dome, the smooth, contoured surface remained unbroken by projections or seams and unmarked by symbols. Mia had walked toward the craft for a closer look and better pictures, but when he had come to within 100 yards, something suddenly checked his progress, "as if I were running against the winds of a soundless storm," he wrote. "With all my power, I fought against it to move forward. I even succeeded in this, but only for a few meters, then the counteracting force was simply too great, and I sat down on the ground, stared over at the object, and waited for what was to come." In less than a minute, a figure had appeared behind the craft. As the figure approached, Mia could see that it was human in form, walked upright on two legs, and had two arms at its side. It was covered up to its neck by a tight, thin one-piece suit, dull gray in color and rough, almost like the hide of an elephant, he thought. A hard ring collar encircled the base of the neck, and the suit ended in darker, ankle-high boots. The being, of course, was the Pleiadian Samjays, a woman with eyes an unusually pale blue. Her amber hair was parted in the middle and fell to her waist, framing her small nose, delicate mouth, and exceedingly high cheekbones. Mia had noted at the time that only two of Semjaze's features truly differed from that of an Earth human. Her small ears joined her head in a straight line instead of a gentle curve, and her white skin was so pale and so perfect it approached luminescence. Semjaze had walked confidently and gracefully towards him, touching his arm and gently helping him to his feet. Then the two of them walked to a tree near which Mia had left his motorbike. There in the grass, for an hour and a quarter, they had talked, Semjaze speaking German so that Mia could understand. Mia wrote in the notes that for a long while the Pleiadians had desired contact with an Earth human who was sincere in assisting them with their mission. They had nurtured and observed him since he was 5 years old, and since he responded adequately to each of several levels of communication, he had continued to be contacted. In January 1975, he finally was ready to learn of the Pleiadian presence and to understand the simple mission for which he had been selected. Semjaze first explained briefly that Pleiadian civilization originated many thousands of years ago, not in the Pleiades, a star system much younger than our own, but in the constellation Lyra. When war ensued, before the planet was destroyed, much of the population migrated to other star systems, in the Pleiades, the Hyades, and to a planet orbiting a nearby star known as Vega. On one interstellar journey, the new Pleiadians discovered Earth and its early life evolving in an atmosphere hospitable to their own. Since that time, according to Semjaze, Earth had been destroyed twice by its own inhabitant, first by a civilization evolved from early Pleiadians who remained behind and mated with primitive Earth humans, and second, when a later generation of Pleiadians colonized Earth and produced advanced technology until war again destroyed the planet. Semjaze and the Pleiadians who had chosen to return again to Earth were descendants of a peaceful Lyrian faction that now felt responsible for guiding Earth in its spiritual evolution, so the Earth humans could avoid the setbacks long ago experienced by their Pleiadian ancestors. To help them in their mission, the Pleiadians had contacted many Earth humans telepathically, but the chosen ones eventually proved to lack knowledge, willingness, or loyalty. The few who possessed these qualities feared exposure, and so, remained silent about the contacts. In the past, we have witnessed those who were unable to determine the truth and were frightened by it, Semjaze told Mia. They claimed they would be accused of insanity, and that others would plan conspiracies to prove they were lying. This serves no purpose for the Earth human or ourselves. If such humans had been sincere, we would have offered them the chance to take clear photo proofs of our beam ships. We have allowed you this already, and in the future will come even greater opportunities. Taking photographs of the Pleiadian beam ships was to be part of Mia's mission. Pictures provided proof that the Pleiadians existed, and this reality was a necessary step before Earth humans would begin to accept the truth that they belong to a network of galactic societies. The Pleiadians themselves were only one of many millions of cosmic races that traveled freely in space. The Earth human calls us extraterrestrials or star people, or however he wants, Semjaze had continued. He attributes to us supernatural abilities, yet knows nothing about us. In truth, we are human beings like the Earth human being, but our knowledge and our wisdom and our technical capabilities are very much superior to his. One of our concerns is aimed at your religions and the detrimental effect they have had on the development of the human spirit. One thing above all has power over the life and death of each creature. This is the creation, laws which are irrefutable and eternally valid. The human being will recognize them in nature, if he troubles himself to look, for they show him the way to spiritual greatness. While the Earth human indulges in religion, the real spirit dwindles. On Earth, she added, charlatans have spread the lie that we come by order of the creation as angels, to bring to the Earth humans the long hoped for peace, the truth, the protection, and the order of your God. This is a lie, for we never have received such orders and we never will. The creation never gives commands. It is a law unto itself, and every form of life must conform to it and become a part of it. Bring this truth to the light of the world. Before they parted that afternoon, Samjays had promised Mia that many contacts would follow, and that she also would transmit thoughts to him telepathically. "Do not worry that I will do this at an unsuitable time," she had said. "I know to regard your character and your will for independence, thus I will always take my directions from you. The time will come when we will meet together in my beamship, and you will be able to fly into space with me. I will inform you later about this." Samjays had then walked back through the meadow to her beamship. Once she was inside, waves again emanated from the craft, distorting the shapes and colors of everything around it. A blue-red corona radiated outward. Mia took several more pictures as the beamship rose slowly above the pine trees and drifted to the north. It was exactly 4 o'clock when he exposed the last frame on his film. An instant later, the beamship shot straight up into the clouds and disappeared from Mia's view. And once again, the stirring had returned to the meadow. One afternoon, with a break in the weather, Stevens asked Mia to take him to one of the contact sites. On his moped, Mears guided Stevens and the interpreter to a grassy bluff near Hastenbowl, about 40 minutes from the farm. On the bluff, Mia had taken a series of photographs in which a beamship approached in the distance. The pictures, recalled Stevens, showed the object beginning as a speck, just a little dark speck, and getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it's the craft hovering behind a tree. Driving up to Hastenbowl, Stevens was impressed by the terrain and puzzled at how Mia could have rigged the photographs to make the beamship appear to fly toward the camera from a point out over a deep valley. But as they neared the site, another problem arose that had never occurred to him. The only way to get to the top of that bluff was by climbing a dirt road barred by a locked gate. Beyond the gate, the road narrowed, and finally became two ruts separated by a wide swath of thick grass cutting through meadow, then traversing steeply up the side of the bluff. At the gate, Stevens stopped the car, located the farmer who owned the land, and had his interpreter ask for permission to pass through the gate and proceed across the meadow. "When we went through there, he looked at everything," remembered Stevens. "He didn't open it, but he came and looked on the back of the moped and at the car, and wanted to know what we were going to do. And I don't think that he would have allowed Mia across there with a moped loaded with discs and rigging equipment. He might have let him in there with all that rigging, but at least he would have known about it." While the farmer looked over the contents of Stevens' rental car and Mia's motorbike, Stevens asked through the interpreter, "Do you remember Mr. Mia here?" The man said, "Yes. He was here over a year ago." "Did he have anything unusual with him at the time?" asked Stevens. "What do you mean?" countered the farmer. "He had cameras and a roll pack strapped on his back, and a tripod on his moped." "No, I didn't see anything like that," replied the farmer. Mia stood next to Stevens. As Stevens asked the questions, "He knew what I was after," Stevens said later, "but he never objected to me asking these questions of him or of anybody else." Later, as they drove back to Schmidruti, Stevens mulled over 3 things about Hastenbowl: the locked gate, the stern and inquisitive farmer, and most of all, the steep drop below the grassy bluff. That and the fact that the object approached from a gray spot in the distance in the haze, getting bigger and bigger and bigger all the way, from over this valley. "I don't see how he could do it." By now, several witnesses had described to Stevens the strange landing tracks left by the beamships, and Stevens wanted to see a set for himself. 2 weeks before his arrival in Switzerland, there had been a contact in a meadow and a set of 3 tracks had been left behind. If nothing had disturbed them, they would still be there, in the short grass. With Mia the directing, Stevens drove to the site, where they got out of the car and walked through the woods to a clearing. Stevens recognized the indentations immediately and understood why they had puzzled so many people before him. "The tracks I looked at had stems bent over that weren't broken and they never stood up," he recalled. "And that's mysterious. How can that happen? All grass stands back up again if you haven't broken the stem. I have never been able to figure out what kind of equipment he could have used to produce those tracks in wet grass without leaving a track to and from, except the one Samjays walked out on. You could salt the ground, but the salt would not make the grass grow greener, and it probably wouldn't grow at all if you salted it too much. When I asked him, he had a ready answer, didn't even stop to think about it. I said, "How come the grass doesn't grow back up?" He said he asked the Pleiadians and they told him it was the magnetic vortices under the landing pads that produced a change in the magnetic orientation in the plant, and the plant grew horizontally in its induced field rather than vertically in a normal field. I could be misreading it, I could be seeing it all wrong. But how in the hell was he going to do that a dozen times over and never get caught? Stevens had investigated over 100 cases in a dozen countries. He had walked landing sites, handled evidence, and talked to witnesses. But the Mir case was different. In Stevens' mind, what set it apart was the number of principal witnesses who had seen something for themselves. Too many seemingly honest people had too many stories about Mir that couldn't be explained, people who had watched him closely, had waited for him to slip, and who had never seen anything suspicious. One of the most common stories Stevens heard was about the time the Pleiadians had teleported Mir out of his office. The office had one window and one door, both locked from the inside with a key. One afternoon, at least two people saw Mir enter the office, but no one saw him leave. Yet later in the afternoon, when everyone thought he was working in his office, he suddenly showed up on the road in front of the farm briefly disoriented, and three men had to break down the office door to get back in. After Stevens heard the story, the next time he and Mir sat down for a question and answer session, he asked Mir to define for him the precise moment he was teleported from Earth to a beamship. Mir, in English, tried to explain, using the example of being in his office. "I maybe sit by the typewriter at the window," he began, "and suddenly I feel a very strong force clearing up everything in my head, but still holding the position of my body by the table. Because I am already going into the ship with Sam Jays. And in that same moment, I know I am sitting in front of the typewriter by the table. But a very short moment only, because I forget everything that is happening here. And then, in this moment, I am there, and not here." This led to another question. Stevens wanted to know where Mir was when he met with the Pleiadians. "If I am now in the ship staying on the ground," said Mir, "or a little bit over the ground, or if we fly off in the atmosphere, or out of the earth into space, or if we are walking around the ship, it is exactly the same. You see, there is the force field, and you always are inside there." But Stevens wondered if during the contacts Mir was somehow in another dimension, or if the experiences with the Pleiadians were similar to astral travel, a state of ecstasy, exhilaration, he suggested. He was implying that perhaps Mir's contacts took place solely on a mental plane and not a physical one. But Mir answered, "I know what this means, astral travel. It isn't anything like that. It's so real, like we are sitting here. You see," he said, "they are really material." J. Stevens understood now why Luzenstag had been reluctant to tell him everything she knew about the Mir case. The 4 days in Schmidruti had been crammed with reading, questioning, viewing, thinking, and wondering. For the first time in 30 years, he felt overwhelmed. He returned to Tucson with 130 new color photographs, many of them far better than the original 12 he had seen Luzenstag arrange across his dining room table. He had several hundred roughly translated pages of the contact notes, and many statements from witnesses who described seeing things unimaginable. Some of them told me they saw him return in the middle of three men standing in a group in a rainstorm. Looked like he just popped out of the ground, and he didn't have any raindrops on him. "That's unique, that a real trick. I never had people present where the witness was teleported. No. Mir's a smart man and he's got a good mind, but he has only one arm, and he's limited in equipment, and he's watched by a lot of people. I don't see how he can do all these things." Stevens went back to Tucson and told his friends Lee and Britt Elders, "If this man is perpetrating a hoax on the world, he is also successfully fooling his wife and his closest friends, and has been doing so for 2.5 years. Steve came back shaking his head, remembered Britt. He didn't know what to do. He spent 3 days at our house saying, You're not going to believe it. You've got to go. You're not going to believe it. I was worried about him, added Lee, because I had observed so many UFO cases he'd been on in the past. He's had 100 field investigations.